Well, it's been quite a shocking start to the week for South Africa. The Rand taking a tumble. And it's all because Donald Trump has now focused his attention on South Africa, well, amongst others, and said that he's withdrawing aid and worse to come, essentially, in the public statements that he has made. A lot of this was sparked by Cyril Ramaphosa signing into law the Expropriation Without Compensation Act. Someone who's been following this saga for 7 years now, at least anyway, is Terence Corrigan from the Institute of Race Relations. Well, Terence, you came back to the Institute of Race IRR in 2018, and shortly thereafter, I recall us setting up a seminar for you in London. Well, you came over to London and you spoke to a room of about 60-odd people and explained to them there that the expropriation without compensation proposals were very dangerous. Now, you've followed that saga all the way through, and today it's fait accompli, I guess, up to a point. I suppose there's still, you can tell us what other remedies there might be. But why have you been so hot on this subject at a time when so many others say, yes, but you know, it's really just lots of other countries have got this and it's really not such a big deal. We shouldn't be making such a big issue of it, even if Donald Trump is.
Well, look, the hard reality of this is that no society grows without property rights, whether those are assumed or those are enshrined in law. Countries that degrade them, whether it's North Korea, whether it's North Vietnam in the 1950s, whether it's China under Mao, whether it's the Soviet Union in the early 1920s, whether it's Zimbabwe, Venezuela, et cetera, they all not only go downhill economically, this is just not compatible with a constitutional democracy. Why do we need property rights? I actually wrote two matching studies about this a couple of years ago. You can actually plot countries' levels of freedom against the levels to which property rights are respected. There are a couple where property rights are respected more than political rights, but basically it's a very strong correlation. Now, what concerns me is that this has been something that I don't think the ANC has ever been fully sold on the idea of property rights for various reasons, partly because there's a very strong Marxist influence with it, and also because it has this idea that it is a kind of new generation East Asian developmental state where the state will discipline capital, which has no capacity to do. So I think that, so for me, this has always been about whether South Africa is going to be, first of all, a prosperous society where we can expand the ownership and disposal of property amongst people who have historically been excluded, which is a very important issue. Don't get me wrong on that. Don my inner Trump. Don't misunderstand. But equally so, this is about whether South Africa will be a constitutional democracy or some sort of rentier state where our communal and individual fortunes are dependent on the say-so of political power.
So really simplify, dumb it down for us. What are private property rights?
Private property rights basically means that the things that you own are yours, and if there is going to be any sort of deprivation of it, it has to go through a very, very rigorous process of checks and balances. There are, The point is about the Expropriation Act. Every country has, from time to time does do expropriation. But the point is that it is a rarity. You know, the phrase safe, legal, and rare, I think, should apply here too. Property rights effectively means that your ability to own things is viewed as a human right, not as a kind of concession the state makes to you. We'll let you have your house as long as we decide it's okay. When you displease us, we can make, we that's a lever we can turn. dissidents in the whole East Bloc, you used to often find things like typewriters being seized. You couldn't necessarily shut up what was in someone's head, but you could make it difficult for them to communicate it. So, it's from that level up to saying that, we can clear this RDP community because, a new look Gupta decides that he wants to come and, he wants to come and build a golf course. We've seen this all over the world. Particularly, dreadful when there's sort of high profile prestige events, sporting tournaments. And it's generally not your upmarket neighborhoods that are hit by this. If anybody comes to seize, the Rupert's wine farm, CNN and every media outlet will be there, plus law firms from five continents to resist it. When it's, someone, whose family have occupied a few hectares of dirt scrabble for a few generations and graze a few cows there, who will even know?
So the point here is that it could be abused in future, not that it is going to be abused now. Because a very strong argument that Cyril Ramaphosa and those who are following his train of thought are saying is, but we would never just take away your homes. But the fact is, if it's law, it could happen. Is that what bugs you?
Yes. Look, okay, there's a few things. In this particular law, the way that compensation is defined feeds off a constitutional court judgment of about a decade ago that held that expropriation does not just mean deprivation. It means that the state has to take ownership. This is basically what happened to water and mineral rights. People who had owned them no longer owned them, but no compensation was regarded as being due because the state now held them in custodianship for the people of South Africa. As far as land goes, there is a very strong sentiment within the state, and possibly with the president himself. I don't know that for sure, but certainly there have been people such as David Masondo who have said that this is what we need to do with land, effectively abolish private property in it. So there is that. The other thing is that when people say, well, President Ramaphosa would never do this. Well, yes, but President Ramaphosa will, all things being equal, will not be the president in a couple of years. And I think even, so that was in South Africa, we do have a kind of messianic strain in our political culture that, we can put all of our faith in a particular leader, and the latest iteration, of course, is good old Cyril. I remember somebody saying, Cyril's got this. I remember Business Day had an editorial saying, he's the master of the long game and knows how this is going to end. Well, even if that is true, and I have serious doubts about it, and even if people really understand his train of thought, which I also have doubts about, well, he won't be there. Now, let's, imagine that, we have a Paul Mashatile, John Floppe presidency down the line. What we've done is you've essentially handed a wonderful abusable a weapon to them that will simply be on the books from day one. It is, I think, a matter of prudence to imagine your worst enemy having access to a particular type of legislation before one goes ahead and greenlights it.
You legislate for the worst possible scenario, a Julius Malema, a Jacob Zuma running the country, and what they could use that legislation towards, not for a reasonable, in your opinion, or in a civilized world's opinion, kind of person. Has this been what has then motivated you? And I ask this because there was a wonderful phrase that President Javier Milei made or referred to a couple of times in his speech in Davos. He said, we are here to embrace the ideas of freedom, which means defending a model which promotes life, liberty, and private property. So he puts private property alongside life and liberty as being part of freedom. South Africans have always loved the idea or the concept of freedom. But if this is an attack on private property, one presumes it would also be an attack on their freedom, or how so?
Well, look, I think that also within our political culture, and this gets back to what I say about the kind of statist orientation, particularly, you know, within, let's say, the ANC side of things, MK and the EFF are sort of outright exponents of it. There's a sense that that property is not really a human right. It's a kind of middle class thing that is just that is dispensable. That's why I called a study that I wrote a few years ago a true human right. I wanted to foreground that. What has animated me? And the first time I really started to think about this was probably about 2008 with the first attempt to recast the expropriation legislation, which had all sorts of funny things about limiting recourse to the courts and whatever, I would like to see a free society that is a normative conviction for me. And I think that once you've degraded the right to hold assets, once you've destroyed private property rights, all one really has then is a kind of dispensation to hold possessions. Property, I think, is something very different, and that also, you know, sets up a relationship between the individual and the state, in, you know, both pragmatic terms, in terms of where your next meal comes from, and also in terms of moral terms as to who holds the whip hand, which shifts it very much in the direction of the state. So, yes, you know, I think that what is at stake here is not just our prosperity, as important as that is, and South Africa has been a dismal performer for, you know, two decades now, but it's also the quality of whether we remain a free society.
So if you are prepared to sacrifice to build assets, to acquire that property on the hill, to work towards something that you really want, then that is part of a motivation, presumably, for growing the economy. But if that's withdrawn from you, if that property on the hill that you've worked your whole life for and sacrificed for to acquire can be taken away from you by a Julius Malema or someone of his ilk into the future, then presumably you would move much more towards a dystopian society of, oh, whatever, who cares? And I guess that has a downward spiral to it. Is that how I'm reading it?
Sure. Yeah. Look, there's the various permutations of it. One is that your decisions in your life become taken by officials. You know, you find a farmer, for instance, you know, might be able to carry on farming, but discovers, you know, down the line that he is essentially no different from a SARS agent. He is simply a civil servant, you know, lacking much agency. The other thing, of course, is that economic power is not only in the ownership of things, but in the access to them. And this is also where the kind of crony capitalism that we've seen in many parts of the world, not least in South Africa, arises. And, you know, the more say over assets a government like South Africa's has, the more inevitable that you are going to have the kind of Gupta-ization. Because, you know, certain people are simply able to access, instead of having freestanding economic agency, which is not without its own set of problems, you have raw political agency that determines your access. And I think that tends to exist within a much, much smaller, more compact, and dare I say it, more systemically corrupt field. Let me point out, you know, a circumstance that does exist in South Africa and has. A lot is made of the inadequacies of land reform, and I think many of those critiques are correct. But I wonder how many of us realize that when it comes to land redistribution, now this is providing land for aspirant farmers as opposed to people who have a historical claim on a particular tract. That it is actually government policy not to transfer ownership. During the David Rakhase case, the state's own papers said, and they used this phrase, black farming households should not have ownership, but they should have long-term leases. It's been said, and this is by somebody who is an energetic critic of the Institute, that the state's lease and disposal policy is basically founded on the assumption that Black people aren't to be trusted with land. And from that we get this idea, the permanent tenant. What exactly is the, in many pragmatic senses, what is the difference between, the homeland landholding system in the 1970s when John Foster was in the Union buildings and those same areas now nominally part of South Africa, now that Cyril Ramaphosa is, is in the same building. Nothing has been changed there. The idea that those people will actually own what they cultivate and what they live on is just not even on the table.
Sure, there's a lot of work to be done. But let's get to the present. Right now, Donald Trump says he will remove all aid to South Africa, $8 billion in the last 10 years. It's a lot of money that will no longer be coming in here as a bit of a freebie. On the other hand, we have a government in South Africa that signed, I don't know if you're even aware of this thing, it's called the Hague Group. We're part of the Hague Group. It was a signature. We signed it yesterday, 31st of January, which is also going to irritate Donald Trump big time. The other members of the Hague Group, and I'm going to read them because it shows what company we're getting into, are Belize, Bolivia, Colombia, Cuba, Honduras, Malaysia, Namibia, Senegal, and us, South Africa. And the whole idea here is to basically end the Israeli occupation of Palestine, as they call it. Now, it's not the strongest group of countries, but it certainly will be getting up some noses. So how do you read what Donald Trump is saying now? International media is saying part of the reason for this is because he's got South African advisors, including Elon Musk, around him, and that the South African government is doing really bad things at the moment. Is this a reaction to the Hague Group? Is this a reaction to expropriation without compensation? And what might he want to achieve?
Look, I think that there are a lot of things going on there. We have warned, in fact, I warned in a statement last week that, pushing this EWC thing endangers our trade privileges. And as I sit here now, I would be very surprised if we retain a GOA access for various reasons, one of which is that it requires the protection of property rights. Now, let me say, I don't say that with any joy. In fact, I fielded a number of delegations from the United States towards the end of last year. To every one of them, I said, do not punish South Africa for the actions of its government, because that risks alienating a lot of people who are otherwise fairly sympathetic. And, I think the Hague Group certainly. I do find that find that a bit amusing, because part of its remit is to protect international law, but us, South Africa has the distinction of helping an indictee to escape its country when its own courts had said that he needed to be arrested, as we recall, Omar Bashir. And I remember Gwede Mantashe saying at the time, oh, well, court orders like this will sometimes be disregarded. Doesn't inspire it. I think Donald Trump is by nature quite mercurial and quite pugilistic. But I would also say I think this is something that South Africa needs to reckon with. One doesn't have to like Donald Trump. One doesn't have to agree with Donald Trump. But South Africa, or the South African state, and more so the ANC as a party, has spent at least 20 years making it clear that it despises America. You read ANC documents. The United States is presented directly as an enemy. Now, people say, well, this is all Donald Trump, and I'm sure over the next couple of days we'll see all sorts of keyboard warriors going on about how, this shows what a dreadful fellow Trump is. Relations and were not particularly warm under Obama. They weren't particularly warm under Joe Biden. In fact, the EFF put out a statement, wishing, ill health and a bad journey to Reuben Brigidy, Biden's ambassador. He literally quoted ANC documents about how dreadful the US was. So, I do think that your one's. A nation's posturing does have consequences. And I think the tragedy for South Africa is we just do not have a particularly competent and skilled diplomatic service. Something that I was asked repeatedly by or that I am asked repeatedly with visitors from abroad: why can South Africa not function like Vietnam or like India, which, you know, have diverse interests and manage to play one off against the other, but can maintain very, very close and cordial relations with the United States, all things considered? India is a member of the BRICS group. It has been very kind of soft soaping on Russia over Ukraine, but it still has very, very intimate and friendly relations with the United States. South Africa, you know, seems to be, you know, it's an archetypal case, I think, of all we have is a hammer, so everything looks like a nail. And I think there is still this view that you are stuck in the, you know, in East Berlin in the 1960s, where, you know, we are conducting this war against imperialism, of which, you know, the Yankees are the avatars. But, you know, we live in a very different world. So, yeah, you know, while I'm sure that Donald Trump has not won any friends in South Africa on any side of the aisle for this, I do think that there is a need for South Africa to do some introspection and ask, you know, how did we get to this point?
Terence, how serious are the consequences?
Okay, I have put this in some of my writings. Anyone wants to look at them, they're mostly on the Daily Friend, I think. If you're talking about America withdrawing aid, AGOA is not existential, but it is useful. So for the, you know, the companies that are able to operate competitively in the United States because of it, it means a great deal to them. So there are jobs at stake. Of course, South Africa has also implemented a minimum wage that has cost, 200,000 jobs, and doesn't seem to be particularly concerned about that. So maybe that's, you know, not an argument that will hit home. I would be very concerned about PEPFAR. You know, that I have a Facebook acquaintance who occasionally publishes these, you know, thank you letters to America on his page, because for him this is existential. This gives him his ARV. So there are people who could, you know, who could die. And I think Fikile Mbalula said something about, well, you know, what have we done to reduce our dependence? And the point is that a country growing at sort of 1% a year just isn't in a position to do that. I mean, a lot of its resources are stolen anyway, or just squandered. You know, they're, once again, you know, the other shows that it's not just about America. Commercial relationships, I think, tend to exist irrespective of the complexion of the government. I would be concerned if there's any blowback in Europe over EWC. If you know, German or Dutch companies start feeling strain, that I think would be existential to us. I think that if there is some sort of major lurch into EWC, you know, it's just sort of game over. Forget Trump, forget trade. So South Africa is at the moment not a particularly attractive jurisdiction to do business in. You know, our investment performance, once again, let me do some shameless self-promotion and say people must read a paper I wrote last year about it. As a proportion of GDP, investment in South Africa comes in at about 16%. Other middle-income countries, that figure is over 30, sometimes closer to 40 and even above. You know, it's just, you know, we're a chronic underperformer. And the more burdens you throw on it, the more things won't happen, which is more important than things that actually do. You know, just expect those, you know, the 33% of the population or the workforce that's unemployed to just keep on growing. Expect, you know, half of the population that's immiserated to become more immiserated. Expect more of those, you know, enterprising business people to look for opportunities abroad. You know, this is serious. Now, you know, I don't think that Elon Musk being, you know, having grown up in South Africa is either here nor there. I don't think that's how he thinks. But I mean, I would like to just put this on the table. Why is Elon Musk in America and not in South Africa? What does America offer, or what did Canada offer that we didn't? And believe me, I think that I know from personal experience, there are plenty of other business people, you know, maybe on a smaller scale, who've decamped for distant shores, taking with them their entrepreneurial capacity, their business plans, their bank balances, and their tax revenues, simply because it has become too difficult to operate in South Africa. Now, you know, Elon Musk said, you know, he would consider introducing Starlink. Now, internet connectivity is something even the government admits is a problem. Yet, unless you're willing to hand out your 30% bribe, you can't operate here. That's not Donald Trump's fault. That's a self-inflicted wound.
What would turn this around? Let's just say that the message has landed, and Ramaphosa and his merry men around him say, "We got to do something to fix this." What would turn it around?
You would need comprehensive policy reform. You would need and for that you would need a change of mindset. So, okay, in order to make South Africa work, you have to actually start treating governance like government, you know, like proper governance. This is not about having turgid document about the hegemony of the most enlightened classes. This is about whether your officials can process the permissions people need expeditiously, can maintain their infrastructure and things like that, and that has not been a priority. So you would need to professionalize the civil service. And I think that the only real signifier.
I'm not talking about long term, Terrence. Yeah. I'm talking about Donald Trump is pissed off at the moment. He wants to punish South Africa. How do you actually roll that back? What do you do if you saw Ramaphosa today to make sure that you're not going to be reaping the whirlwind of resentment and vengeance that seems to be driving Trump in this respect anyway?
Well, look, unfortunately, South Africa has put itself in this position over a long period. So I'm not sure it short term solutions are even possible. I suppose that they could you could do things like stepping back from the case against Israel. But I'm not naive enough to believe that South Africa would even countenance that, because that is an ideological issue. You could, rethink things like NHI and like the Expropriation Act, but I think that would also be to concede, that the foundational premises were wrong, and I don't think that the Trump opposer would be prepared to do that. Look, I think one thing that might have some purchase, and I don't know if this is going to land with Donald Trump, because I think that's something that unfortunately the ANC has locked us into, that confrontational relationship. But for the ANC and government to actually start taking the GNU seriously, which in the first instance I think the DA should have been accorded more seats. I think that the idea that the president signs a bill and then just announces it on social media, it just says that they're not serious about that. I think things like that would at least communicate to business people, if not to foreign governments. But look, Trump was the choice of the American electorate, mercurial, pugilistic, and I think that's in a sense a political black swan that we were not prepared for. Perhaps President Ramaphosa could ask to speak to him, go and fly over and spend a few days at Mar-a-Lago trying to play golf. But I think he would actually have to take some sort of proper proposal, that we actually don't intend to use this, or we're going to be amending it to specify the definition of export, change the definition of expropriation. But as I say, I think unfortunately we are where we are now, and I'm not sure how we step away from it. Well, how the ANC will step away from it.
Terrence Corrigan is with the Institute of Race Relations. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.